A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
2.5 hours. That's what the audience buys a ticket for. 2.5 hours of transcendent escape, the orchestra swelling, the lights hitting just right. What they don't see is the 8 hours of silent, grinding, almost monastic discipline that starts long before the overture and doesn't end until well after the stage door clears.
It's not just the audience who misses it. Most coverage of theater focuses on the performance, the reviews, the red carpets. But the actual day, the machinery of it, is where the real story is, especially right now. Tony nominations just dropped for 2026, and the West End is heading into its summer season. So the physical toll of 8 shows a week is suddenly under a microscope again.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to know what a day in the life actually looks like for a principal actor on a major Broadway or West End production. Not the highlight reel, not the interview anecdotes, but the full, unglamorous 16-hour cycle of vocal prep, physical maintenance, performance, and recovery.
Before we dive in, quick note. Today's script is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, which feels appropriate for an episode about precision and discipline.
I'll take it. So where do we even start? Because I think most people, if you ask them to sketch out an actor's day, they'd draw something laughably simple. Show up at 6, get into costume, do the thing, go home.
And that sketch misses about 80% of the labor. The reality is closer to what professional athletes go through. We're talking about people who are essentially vocal marathoners. A principal in a musical like Wicked or Hamilton is singing for up to 90 minutes of a 2.5-hour show, often in extreme ranges, while dancing, while hitting precise emotional beats, while adapting to whatever the audience throws at them.
The schedule itself is punishing in a way that's almost invisible from the outside. Most major houses run 8 shows a week, Tuesday through Saturday evenings, plus Wednesday and Saturday matinees. That means Wednesday and Saturday are 2 show days, where you've got a 2 o'clock matinee and an 8 o'clock evening show, with maybe 2 to 3 hours of actual recovery time in between.
The math is brutal when you lay it out. A 2-show day can mean 12 to 14 hours in or near the theater. The matinee wraps around 4:30, 5 o'clock. Evening call is usually 6:30 for an 8 o'clock curtain. That gap is not downtime. It's a frantic window for vocal rest, rehydration, maybe a physio session if something's tweaked, and a carefully timed meal that won't cause reflux during the second performance.
The single show days aren't exactly light either. An 8 o'clock curtain on a Friday night still means a 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock start to the actor's day if you count the full prep cycle. The morning is largely about preservation. Vocal rest is the default. There's a culture of what some actors call the silent morning, where they genuinely don't speak for the first few hours after waking up.
That's not superstition. That's physiology. The vocal folds are tissues. They swell slightly overnight from fluid redistribution when you're lying flat. Jumping straight into conversation or a vocal warm-up without letting that settle can cause microtrauma. So actors on 8-show contracts often wake up, hydrate with room temperature water, and communicate via text or notepad until 10 or 11 in the morning. It sounds extreme, but when your livelihood depends on 2 tiny strips of mucous membrane vibrating hundreds of times per second, you get religious about it.
There's something almost monkish about that image. Someone in a Manhattan apartment, sunlight coming through the blinds, sitting there in total silence, sipping water, while their phone buzzes with messages they won't voice, answer for another 3 hours.
That's just the warm-up to the warm-up. Once they do start using their voice, the ramp is extremely gradual. Broadway vocal coaches have developed very specific, evidence-based protocols. The cast of The Lion King, for instance, there was a 2025 Actors' Equity Study that documented their standard warm-up sequence. 20 minutes of sirens and lip trills before they even touch repertoire.
You mean those sliding vocalizations that go from low to high and back?
They're a semi-occluded vocal tract exercise. The idea is you're creating back pressure in the vocal tract that helps the folds vibrate more efficiently with less collision force. Lip trills, same principle. Straw phonation, where you literally hum through a straw into a water bottle, is another one. It looks ridiculous, but it reduces the mechanical stress on the folds by something like 30 to 40% during warm-up. The science on this has gotten very robust in the last decade.
You've got someone standing in their kitchen at 10:30 in the morning, blowing bubbles into a water bottle through a straw, sounding like a malfunctioning espresso machine. And this is what keeps a million-dollar production running.
And the stakes are not abstract. A 2024 survey by the British Association for Performing Arts Medicine found that 62% of West End performers reported at least one vocal injury during a single contract run. That's the majority of performers getting hurt at some point. And a vocal injury on a show like that isn't like a sprained ankle where you can tape it up and limp through. If your voice goes, the show doesn't happen, or an understudy goes on with very little notice.
Which brings us to another dimension that gets overlooked. The physical maintenance beyond the voice. A lot of these shows are dance heavy. Principals in those productions aren't just singing, they're doing what amounts to high-intensity interval training while hitting high Cs.
And the cumulative injury risk across a 6 to 9 month contract is enormous. Many actors have a standing 45-minute physio or Pilates session before noon, even on show days. It's not optional. The goal is to catch small imbalances before they become injuries that sideline you. A tight hip flexor on Monday becomes a compensatory movement pattern by Wednesday, and by Saturday you've got a stress fracture and you're out for 6 weeks.
The contract length matters here too. The average principal contract on Broadway runs 6 to 9 months, according to that same 2025 equity report. Some shows require 6-day work weeks. That's a long time to maintain peak physical condition without a meaningful break. And unlike a sports season, there's no off-season built in. You finish one contract and ideally roll into the next.
The matinee day timeline is where all of this gets compressed to its most intense form. Let's walk through a Wednesday. The actor has done the silent morning, the gradual vocal warm-up, maybe the physio session. But now the call time is 1 o'clock for a 2 o'clock matinee, so the whole prep sequence has to shift forward. Lunch becomes a strategic decision. You need enough fuel to get through a 2.5-hour show, but not so much that you feel heavy or trigger acid reflux when you're singing in a supine position.
What does that meal actually look like?
It's often something like plain chicken breast and white rice with steamed vegetables. Low fat, low acid, low spice, nothing that's going to sit in the stomach or irritate the esophagus. A lot of actors avoid dairy entirely on show days because it can thicken mucus. Caffeine is a diuretic, so that's limited, and they're eating this at 11:30 in the morning, so it's fully digested by the 2 o'clock downbeat. It's not glamorous.
Then they do the show. 2.5 hours of full-out performance. Curtain comes down around 4:30. And now they've got roughly 2 hours before the whole cycle starts again for the evening show. What do you do with that window?
The priority is vocal recovery and refueling. A lot of actors will do a brief vocal cool-down, gentle descending slides, light humming. The goal is to release any tension that's accumulated in the laryngeal muscles. Then, it's about rehydration. Not just water, but electrolytes. You've lost fluid through sweat and respiration for 2+ hours. A 2024 West End survey found that 73% of principals reported using a personal steam inhaler before matinees, and that number is even higher for the gap between shows on a two-show day.
A steam inhaler. So you finish a matinee, go back to your dressing room, and basically stick your face into a personal sauna to keep your vocal folds from drying out.
It's not complicated technology, but it makes a measurable difference. Vocal folds need to be lubricated to vibrate efficiently. Dry folds mean more friction, more effort to produce the same sound, and a higher risk of irritation. 15 minutes with a steam inhaler can reset the tissue hydration enough to get you through the evening show without pushing.
Then there's the food piece again. Another carefully calibrated meal, and then the whole warm-up sequence starts over. Sirens, lip trills, straw phonation. The same 20 to 30 minute ritual they did this morning. But now it's 6:30 in the evening and they've already done a full show.
This is where the psychological discipline comes in. Doing the full warm-up again when your body is already tired, when the matinee audience was maybe a bit flat and you had to work harder to generate energy in the room, that takes a kind of professional rigor that has nothing to do with talent. It's just showing up and doing the unglamorous thing again because you know skipping it means you'll blow out by the Thursday evening show.
The thing is, the audience at the 8 o'clock show doesn't know any of this. They don't know you've already done this once today. They don't know you've been awake and silently preparing since 8 in the morning. They just see the lights come up and expect the same performance the Wednesday matinee crowd got. The contract with the audience doesn't have a two-show day clause.
The performance itself is almost the easy part. It's the 12 hours of scaffolding around it that determines whether you can still hit the same notes in month 6 of the contract that you hit on opening night. What most people think of as the actor's day, the show, is really just the visible tip of an enormous iceberg of preparation and recovery.
We've been talking mostly about the morning and the gap between shows, but there's a whole other layer once the actor actually steps into the theater. The half-hour call, the fight call, the costume check, the wig application. That pre-show sequence is its own ritual, and it's governed by union rules as much as tradition.
The half-hour call is a great example of something that sounds like theater folklore but is actually a union-mandated requirement. Actors' equity rules state that performers must be in the theater and ready 30 minutes before curtain. There's a 5-minute places call before the overture, and this isn't flexible. If you're not there, you're in breach of contract. The stage manager logs it.
What's actually happening in that half hour? Because the audience is out in the lobby buying overpriced drinks, and backstage, it's this controlled chaos of physical and vocal warm-ups, costume fittings, and for shows with any kind of staged combat, something called a fight call.
Fight call is fascinating. It's a full run-through of every staged combat sequence in the show, done at half speed or three-quarter speed, just to make sure the choreography is fresh in the performer's muscle memory. Even if you've done the show 200 times, you run the fight before every single performance. It's a safety protocol as much as an artistic one. A mistimed punch or a misjudged distance on a fall can result in a concussion or a broken bone, and that's happened.
There's a case from a few years ago where an actor in a Broadway production missed a grab during a staged fall and shattered his orbital bone. He finished the show, because that's the culture, but he was in surgery the next morning. Fight call exists to prevent exactly that.
It's not just the combat. The physical warm-up before a show is tailored to what the performer is about to do. A swing dancer in Hamilton is doing dynamic stretches, core activation, maybe some light cardio. The dramatic actor is doing breathwork, grounding exercises, maybe running lines for the scenes they find trickiest.
There's also the costume and wig check. In a show like The Lion King or Wicked, the costumes are engineering marvels. They have to be checked for any wear and tear, any loose fastenings, because a wardrobe malfunction in a show with puppetry or aerial work isn't just embarrassing, it's dangerous. Wig application alone can take 20 to 30 minutes for principals, and it has to be done in a specific order relative to the vocal warm-up, because you can't exactly do lip trills once the wig cap and adhesive are on.
The timeline is sequenced down to the minute for a lot of these performers. At 30 minutes to curtain, they're doing fight call. At 20 minutes, they're in the chair for wig and makeup touch-ups. At 15 minutes, they're doing the final vocal warm-up in their dressing room. At 10 minutes, they're in costume, doing a final physical stretch in the wings. At 5 minutes, places. The overture starts, and then they're on.
What strikes me about all of this is how much of it is invisible labor. The audience sees the product, not the process. And that's by design. Theater is supposed to feel effortless. That's the magic. But the effortlessness is a construction, built on this enormous scaffold of discipline and maintenance that nobody ever applauds.
That brings us to the performance itself. Because once the curtain goes up, the physical demands don't stop, but they're joined by a whole new category of cognitive load. Live performance requires a kind of split consciousness that's very different from film acting. You're maintaining character, hitting your marks, staying in the lighting, adapting to the audience, and also monitoring for anything that's going wrong, a dropped prop, a missed entrance, an understudy who's suddenly on stage with you, and you need to adjust your blocking in real time.
We'll get deeper into that cognitive side in a moment. But I think the physical piece we've laid out here is worth sitting with. The silent mornings, the straw phonation, the steam inhalers, the precisely timed chicken and rice, the fight calls, the 30-minute wig applications. This is the day before the day, and the day before the evening, and it repeats 8 times a week for months on end. Most people couldn't sustain this for a week. These performers do it for years.
The thing is, what we've just described is the version of the day that goes according to plan. But the schedule itself is brutal in a way that most people don't grasp until they see it laid out. Let's actually map the full week, because the rhythm of it is where the real toll lives.
Most major houses run 8 shows a week, Tuesday through Saturday evenings, plus Wednesday and Saturday matinees. Monday is the day off, which sounds generous until you realize it's really a recovery day, not a free day. A lot of performers spend Monday doing physio, vocal rest, meal prep for the week. It's not a weekend, it's maintenance.
The 2-show days, Wednesday and Saturday, are the crucible. On a Wednesday, the actor's call might be 1 o'clock for a 2 o'clock matinee. That show runs until about 4:30. Then there's a gap of roughly 2.5 hours before the 6:30 call for the 8 o'clock evening show. You're in the theater from 1 in the afternoon until 11 at night. That's 10 hours in the building, plus whatever you did in the morning for vocal rest and physical prep. It's easily a 14-hour commitment.
A single show day looks completely different. On a Thursday, with only an evening performance, the call might not be until 6:30. That gives the actor a different kind of morning. Maybe they sleep until 9. Maybe they do a longer workout, a proper Pilates session. The body gets a different recovery curve, but the discipline doesn't relax. You're still not speaking before 10. You're still doing the full warm-up. You're just doing it on a shifted timeline.
This is where the composite character we're building helps. If you take a principal actor carrying a lead role in a major musical, their week has 2 completely different templates. The 2-show day template and the single show day template. And they're alternating these templates across 6 days with only Monday to reset. The cognitive load of just managing which template you're on, what time you need to eat, when you start hydration, when you stop talking, that's its own job.
It's not just the lead. The ensemble in swings are often on an even more demanding schedule. A swing might be covering 5 to 10 different tracks and has to be ready to go on for any of them with sometimes 30 minutes notice. Their day includes reviewing multiple sets of blocking, multiple costume changes, multiple vocal parts. The mental map they're holding is vastly more complex.
Which brings us to an important framing point. The walkthrough we're doing today is a composite. It's based on interviews with current Broadway and West End principals, the published routines from vocal coaches, the union guidelines, the medical surveys. No single performer's day looks exactly like this. But the composite captures the real demands. The 16-hour cycle we're describing isn't hyperbole. For someone carrying a 90-minute to 2.5-hour show on their voice and body 8 times a week, the unseen infrastructure is the story.
The infrastructure varies by show type. A street play like the Lehman Trilogy, which is 3 actors doing a 3-hour dramatic marathon, has a completely different physical profile than 6, which is 90 minutes of high-energy pop concert energy with no intermission. The Lehman actors are managing vocal stamina and psychological endurance. The 6 cast is managing cardiovascular output and joint impact. The warm-ups are different. The cool-downs are different. The injury risks are different. But the underlying principle is the same. The performance is the tip of the iceberg.
There's a 2024 study from the British Association for Performing Arts Medicine that quantified something we've been circling. 62% of West End performers reported at least 1 vocal injury during a single contract run, not across a career. During 1 contract, 6 to 9 months. And these aren't always catastrophic injuries that stop the show. There are things like vocal fold swelling, nodules, hemorrhages that the performer sings through while getting treatment, hoping it doesn't get worse before the contract ends.
That number tells you that the maintenance isn't just about optimization. It's about survival. The people who last in this profession are the ones who treat their body like a professional athlete treats theirs. The discipline isn't optional. It's the difference between finishing the contract and being replaced by your understudy in month 4.
When we walk through this day chronologically, from the silent morning at 8 a.m. to the stage door at midnight, what we're really mapping is a system of preservation. Every choice, the steam inhaler, the straw phonation, the time meal, the fight call, the cool down, is a decision made to protect the instrument so it can deliver again tomorrow. And the day after that.
Here's the thing that most audiences never consider. The actor is doing all of this while also managing the ordinary logistics of life. They have rent to pay, relationships to maintain, maybe kids to parent. They're doing a 14-hour day and then going home to a normal apartment, not a recovery suite. The discipline extends into every corner of their existence.
That discipline is especially visible when you walk through the morning of a two-show Wednesday. The actor wakes up around 8, and the first thing they don't do is speak. No phone calls, no chatting with a spouse, no humming along to the radio. The vocal folds have been resting all night, but they're dehydrated from 8 hours of breathing dry air. Speaking before the vocal mechanism is properly lubricated is like revving a cold engine.
I've heard performers describe the first hour as almost monastic. They'll use a whiteboard or a notes app to communicate with family members. A single shouted phrase across the apartment can produce enough vocal fold collision to create microtears if the tissue isn't ready. And those microtears accumulate.
The hydration protocol starts the moment they wake up. Room temperature water, not cold, because cold liquid constricts the blood vessels around the vocal folds. Most performers aim for half a liter before they even get out of bed. Then there's the steam ritual. The steam rehydrates the vocal folds directly, bypassing the digestive system. Drinking water takes about 4 hours to reach the laryngeal tissue. Steam takes about 10 minutes.
That's the kind of detail that separates the pros from the amateurs. Systemic hydration versus topical hydration. You need both. The water you drink now is for the evening show. The steam you inhale now is for the matinee.
Around 9:30, once they've had their steam and their first real hydration, they start the vocal warm-up. The dominant approach now, adopted by vocal coaches across Broadway and the West End, is semi-occluded vocal tract exercise. The most common version is straw phonation. You take a small stirring straw, put it in your mouth, and you phonate through it, humming or producing vowel sounds through the straw. This creates back pressure in the vocal tract, which pushes the vocal folds apart slightly, reducing the collision force while still engaging the muscles. It's a low-impact way to wake up the mechanism.
The Lion King cast has a documented warm-up sequence from a 2025 Actors' Equity study. 20 minutes of sirens and lip trills. The siren is that sliding pitch from low to high and back down, which stretches the vocal folds through their full range gradually. The lip trills create the same semi-occluded effect as the straw. The whole sequence is designed to increase blood flow to the laryngeal muscles without impact.
There's a neurological component here that most people miss. The vocal warm-up isn't just about the tissue. It's about re-establishing the brain-body connection. Singing and stage speech require extraordinarily fine motor control of the larynx, the tongue, the soft palate, the diaphragm. The warm-up is recalibrating all of those pathways. A performer who skips the warm-up isn't just risking injury. They're performing below their capability because the neural mapping isn't primed.
While the vocal warm-up is happening, the physical maintenance is also underway. For dance-heavy shows, many actors have a 45-minute physio or Pilates session scheduled before noon. This isn't a workout. It's targeted maintenance. The physio is looking at the specific joints and muscle groups that take the most punishment. For Elphaba, who's in the air during defying gravity, it's shoulder stability and core engagement. For the ensemble in and Juliet, which is basically 90 minutes of high-energy pop choreography, it's ankles, knees, hip flexes. The cumulative injury risk across a 6-month contract is the real concern. A single show might leave you sore. 192 shows, which is what 8 shows a week for 6 months works out to. That's where chronic injury lives. Plantar fasciitis, stress fractures, vocal nodules. The physio sessions are about catching the small imbalances before they become show-stopping injuries.
Then there's the food. On a 2-show day, the meal timing is precise. The actor eats a substantial breakfast around 10 after the vocal warm-up, but with enough time to digest before the 1 o'clock call. The meal itself is carefully chosen. Low acid, to avoid reflux. Low fat, because a heavy meal sits in the stomach and presses upward against the diaphragm, restricting breath support. Most performers default to some version of chicken and rice or salmon and sweet potato. Simple proteins, complex carbs, nothing spicy, nothing fried, no dairy if they're sensitive.
Dairy is a big one. It promotes mucus production in a lot of people, and the last thing you want before singing is phlegm on the vocal folds. So no lattes, no cheese, no yogurt on a show day. Some performers avoid dairy entirely during a contract.
By 11:30, the actor is packed and heading to the theater. They've done their steam, their straw work, their physio, their timed meal. They've been awake for 3.5 hours and haven't spoken a single word out loud to another human being. That's the silent morning. And now the 1 o'clock call for a 2 o'clock matinee is bearing down.
The matinee call compresses everything. On an evening-only day, the call is at 6:30 for an 8 o'clock curtain. You have the whole day to hydrate, do a longer warm-up, maybe take a nap. On a matinee day, you're in the building by 1, which means your entire pre-show routine has to be done by 12:30, so you can travel. It's the same volume of preparation crammed into a smaller window. And then you have to do it all again, in a compressed recovery window, before the evening show.
The two-show day vocal fatigue management is where the real artistry of maintenance comes in. After the matinee ends at 4:30, the actor has about 2.5 hours before the 6:30 call. During that gap, they're not resting. They're doing a shorter version of the morning protocol. More steam, more hydration, a light meal around 5 that won't sit heavy, and then a second full vocal warm-up. The challenge is that the vocal folds are already fatigued from the matinee. The warm-up has to be gentler, more focused on reducing swelling than on building range.
Some performers use what's called a cool-down after the matinee, which is the vocal equivalent of stretching after a run. Gentle descending scales, soft humming, anything that brings the vocal folds back to a resting state without abrupt disengagement. The performer who skips the cool-down and just starts talking normally after the matinee is setting themselves up for strain in the evening show.
This is where the 62% injury statistic really lands. If you're doing this protocol perfectly, twice a day, Wednesday and Saturday for 6 months, you're still at risk. If you cut corners, if you skip the steam one day because you're running late, if you eat the wrong thing because you're exhausted and just want comfort food, the margin for error is razor thin. The people who survive multiple contracts are the ones who treat the discipline as non-negotiable.
That same non-negotiable discipline carries over once the actor steps into the building, because now the union-mandated rituals kick in. The half-hour call, 30 minutes before curtain, you must be in the theater in the building, accounted for. It's not a suggestion. It's a contractual obligation with real consequences if you miss it.
The half-hour call triggers a sequence that's basically choreographed. The actor arrives, signs in, and immediately starts the physical warm-up. For a straight play, this might be 15 minutes of stretching and articulation. For a musical, it's more like 25. The physical warm-up isn't just about injury prevention either. It's about reconnecting the body to the character. The way a character stands, walks, holds tension in their shoulders. That's all physical memory that needs to be accessed before the first line.
Then comes the vocal warm-up, round 2 of the day. By this point, the actor has already done their morning straw work and lip trills at home, but now they're in the building, and the acoustics are different, the air is different, the backstage dust is different. They need to recalibrate.
The half-hour call vocal warm-up is shorter and more targeted. The actor already knows where their voice is sitting that day. Maybe the matinee left them a little swollen on the upper register, so this warm-up is diagnostic. They're testing range, finding the edges, making adjustments. Some performers do this in their dressing room. Others prefer the stage itself before the house opens because they want to feel how the room responds.
While the vocal warm-up is happening, the costume department is doing their check. The actor steps into the first layer of the costume, and the dresser is looking at every seam, every fastener. A broken zipper at the 5-minute call is a crisis. For shows with quick changes, the dresser is mapping out exactly where they'll be for each change. There's a choreography to the costume work that's as precise as anything on stage.
Same with the wig department. The wig application for a principal can take 20 to 30 minutes. It's not just putting a wig on, it's securing it with pins and adhesive so it survives 2.5 hours of movement and sweat. The wig mistress is checking the hairline, making sure nothing shifted since the last show, and the actor is sitting there doing their vocal warm-up while someone is literally gluing a wig to their scalp. Multitasking on a level most professions never see.
Then there's fight call. For any show with stage combat, fight call is mandatory. The actors run through every moment of physical contact at half speed. Every punch, every slap, every throw. The fight captain is watching for spacing, for timing, for any sign that someone's tired or compensating. If a stunt looks off, they stop it and reset. You don't discover a spacing problem during a live performance. That's how people get hurt.
The thing about fight call is that it's also a trust ritual. These actors are about to simulate violence in front of 1,500 people. They need to know, in their bodies, that their scene partner is present and precise. A sword fight that's been done 200 times can become automatic, and automatic is dangerous. Fight Call pulls it back into conscious awareness. It says, "We are about to do something risky, and we are doing it together, and we are going to be careful."
By 7:30, the half hour has elapsed. The 5-minute call goes out over the backstage speakers. This is when the actor does their final check. Wig secure, costume fastened, mic pack placed and tested. For musicals, the sound department is doing a final mic check. The actor speaks a few lines of performance volume so the engineer can set levels. Then they find their opening position. Some actors stand in the wings in complete silence. Others do a final physical shakeout, rolling their shoulders, bouncing on their toes. The overture starts, or the house lights dim, and then they're on.
Now we're in the performance itself, 8 o'clock to 10:30. This is the part the audience sees. But what's happening cognitively is something that film acting never demands. A film actor does a scene, gets feedback, does it again. They're building a performance across takes. A stage actor does it once, in real time, with no reset, and they're doing it while processing an enormous amount of live information.
The audience is a variable that changes every night. A Tuesday audience is different from a Saturday audience. A matinee audience, often older or more tourist-heavy, responds differently than an evening crowd. The actor feels that energy in real time. A laugh that lands differently. A silence that hangs longer. Applause that cuts off a line. They're adjusting pacing, timing, even vocal projection, moment to moment, without breaking character.
Then there are the things that go wrong. A prop isn't where it's supposed to be. A fellow actor skips a line. An understudy you've never rehearsed with is suddenly playing your scene partner because the principal called out sick 20 minutes before curtain. The actor has to absorb all of this, solve it in character, and make it look like it was always supposed to happen. That's not acting in the conventional sense, that's high-stakes improvisation inside a fixed script.
The understudy situation is worth pausing on. Hamilton on Broadway has swings who cover up to 12 different ensemble tracks. Each track has its own choreography, its own blocking, its own vocal parts. A swing can get a call at 7:30, half an hour before curtain, saying you're on for track 7 tonight, and they have to deliver a performance that the audience can't distinguish from the person who's done it 200 times. The cognitive load of holding 12 complete shows in your head and being able to access any one of them instantly is staggering.
The swing binder is a real thing. It's a document, sometimes hundreds of pages, that maps out every piece of blocking, every dance step, every costume change, for every track the swing covers. They study it constantly. They watch the show from the wings on nights they're not performing, mentally running the track they're covering. And when they go on, the stage manager is often feeding them cues through an earpiece for the first few minutes, just to make sure they're oriented. It's one of the most demanding jobs in theater, and audiences rarely know it exists.
The flow state that actors talk about is what happens when all of this, the character, the choreography, the audience, the adjustments, the problem solving, integrates into a single, seamless experience. The actor isn't thinking about individual choices anymore. They're just in it. A 2.5-hour show can feel like 20 minutes. That's the peak experience. But getting there requires all the preparation we've been describing. Flow isn't magic. It's what happens when the preparation is so thorough that the conscious mind can step back and let the body do what it's been trained to do.
The difference from film is instructive. A film actor can have a bad take and do it again. They can break character between setups. They can rely on the editor to assemble the performance. A stage actor has none of that. The performance is the take. If you lose focus for 30 seconds, the audience sees it. If you're emotionally off, the scene suffers and you can't call cut. That pressure is what makes live performance uniquely demanding, but also uniquely rewarding. The connection with the audience is real and immediate, in a way that film can't replicate.
Then the curtain drops. The bows happen. But that curtain call is interesting in itself. I think most people see it as the actors taking a bow, soaking up applause, and that's the end. But if you watch closely, you can actually see the moment the character releases and the person comes back. It's subtle. Sometimes it's just a shift in the shoulders or a different quality of eye contact with the audience. The actor is still on stage, still being watched, but they're transitioning back to themselves in real time.
That transition isn't just symbolic, it's physiological. There's a post-show adrenaline crash that hits about 20 minutes after Bose. The actor's been running at peak sympathetic nervous system activation for 2.5 hours. Heart rate elevated, cortisol pumping, hyper-focused. When the curtain drops, the parasympathetic system has to take over, and it doesn't always do that smoothly. That's why the cool-down protocols matter so much.
The vocal cool-down is the mirror image of the morning warm-up. The actor has just spent 2+ hours projecting to the back of a 2,000-seat house, often over a full orchestra. The vocal folds are swollen. If they just walk out of the theater and start talking normally, they're setting themselves up for damage. So they do 5 to 10 minutes of gentle descending sirens, soft humming, maybe some light straw work again. The goal is to bring the voice down from performance mode to rest mode gradually.
For dance-heavy shows, the physical cool-down is even more intensive. Performers from Wicked and Juliet do full ice baths after a 2-show day. Not because they're injured, but because the cumulative inflammation from 16 dance numbers across 2 performances is significant. Ice bath, compression boots, sometimes 20 minutes of foam rolling before they even think about leaving the theater. The post-show routine for a musical dancer can take 45 minutes.
This is where the larger insight starts to come into focus. When you step back and look at the whole day we've described, from the silent morning at 8 a.m. to the ice bath at 11 p.m., the actual performance, the 2.5 hours the audience sees, is maybe 20% of the total commitment. The other 80% is maintenance. Vocal maintenance, physical maintenance, nutritional discipline, sleep hygiene, mental preparation, cool down. The show is the tip of an enormous iceberg.
And I think this is the single biggest misconception about professional theater acting. People imagine it's primarily about talent, about that NF.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.